You're listening to the Isaka podcast. In this security series podcast, we're speaking with Dustin Brewer, Isaka's cybersecurity platform engineer, Ed Moyle, Isaka's director of thought leadership and research, and Frank Downs, Isaka's senior manager of cyber information security practices. In this podcast, we're discussing the Meltdown and Spectre vulnerabilities, the responses to them, and how you can remain safe in light of them. So to begin, Ed, can you give us some background information on these vulnerabilities?
So the issue has to do with side channel attacks against the functionality within modern processor design called speculative execution, right? So speculative execution is basically an optimization method. The analogy that, you know, one might look at it as is like kind of a recipe, right? Like if you're a cook and you're following a recipe, you know, all of those steps in the recipe have to kind of be completed in sequential fashion. Like, so for example, right, you want to preheat the oven before you can put the bread into it, right? But if you wait for each line in the recipe to complete, it's super efficient, right? So like what you might do is while the oven is preheating, you're, you know, flouring the surface that you're going to need the bread on or whatever, right? So you're basically following instructions out of order, in some cases doing as much as you can on a future step ahead of time while you're waiting for a given step to complete, right? And this is exactly what happens, what a processor does, right? So the processor might have an instruction that in the pipeline that takes a long time, right? So for example, you know, it might have a bunch of instructions that it can do on the processor itself, like in the registers that are built into that CPU. And then it might have one that requires that you go off and fetch memory, right? Which, you know, even though that doesn't take a long time from a human point of view, it does take a long time from the computer's point of view, right? So while it's going off and it's fetching that, it's actually pre-computing things ahead of time so that when that instruction resolves, it can immediately then, you know, use the pre-done work and fill it, right? So speculative execution is kind of like, is that, except for it's making a guess about what a decision is going to be. Like, so for example, right, if there's a calculation that needs to resolve and based on the results of it, it'll do A or B, it might actually go ahead and go down and say, all right, I've seen this happen 1,000 times before. It's always B. I'm going to assume it's going to be B now, and I'm going to do the pre-execution of path B, and then based on the results of that, then I'm going to, you know, to have done this work ahead of time. Now, it could be that the CPU is wrong, right? And if that's the case, then, you know, it's as if it would be performance similar to idling, right? Because it was wrong. It just resets the state back to, you know, to what it would have been had it not gone down that path, rolls back, unwinds the changes, and you know, and goes from there. But basically what these attacks do, both Meltdown and Spectre, they work in such a way that they're able to, through side channel information gathering, they are able to measure the impact even after that's, you know, even though that unwinding occurs, there's still changes that happen. They're able to measure those changes and use it to gather information. So that's basically, like, in a nutshell, how the attack works. I mean, Dustin, Frank, do you have anything that I left out of there that you think would be useful for folks to understand it?
Yeah, I think you definitely hit the nail on the head there. One of the caveats to add into there is that, you know, while it's going through and it's doing the speculative calculations and everything, it's actually storing some of that information to cache, and that's kind of how it sideloads it as well, and can get some information out of a subroutine.
Absolutely. So there's some things that I think are important to tell people, right? Like just about this that matter to them from a practical standpoint, right? So the first one is, I think it's important that people understand that, you know, number one, this is like a hardware issue. So like everything, you know, it's the truth that, you know, pretty much most platforms are impacted by this, right? But it's also the case, at least right now, that you know, we're not seeing a lot of in the wild attacks that leverage this, right? You know, this is people proving that you can do this, right? But it's not, you know, we're not seeing attackers across the board, you know, leveraging this as part of their tradecraft, right? Now that could change, but at least for right now, you know, it's not something that we're seeing a ton of in the wild yet. Now, you know, there's exploits out there, right? There's proof of concept code that exists that's up on, you know, public information repositories and such like that. So that's likely to change, but, you know, that's kind of the state of it as of right now. So that's number one. And then number two is that, you know, also keep in mind that right now this is information disclosure, right? So this is people who are, like, using it to snoop on secrets across boundaries. Like, so, for example, like, if you're in virtual image A, you can potentially snoop on something on the hypervisor or image B, right? But it's not like, you know, it's not like, you know, an example would be something like Rowhammer, right? Or Flip Feng Shui, right? Which is where you're actually changing data in another, you know, in another virtual machine or across that boundary. So, like, you know, yes, it's a big deal. Yes, it should be taken seriously. Obviously, apply the patch and such like that. But, you know, but also, at least for the very short term, you know, it's still, you know, have some reason in terms of how you approach the actual risk impact of this thing.
Right. And not only that, but, I mean, it affects all x86 processors, right, which is like, okay, we're talking about not only, like, you know, okay, well, I use a Mac. Well, guess what? You know, Mac uses x86 as well. yeah, you're still going to be in trouble. Well, you know, I usually use my phone for most things. Well, guess what? It affects ARM processors, and that every single phone in the world uses an ARM, pretty much every single phone uses an ARM processor nowadays, every smartphone anyways. So, I mean, it affects everything at a hardware level, and I mean, that in itself is pretty scary.
And, yeah, Ed, you mentioned that there's a bunch of proof of concept out there, so someone's going to be able to leverage it sooner or later. I know at least one person on the call who's been able to leverage some of that code today, Mr. Brewer.
Yeah, no, if you go on exploitdb.com, there is a proof of concept for Spectre, and, you know, it's nothing fancy. It just basically, it'll throw up an array. The program will create an array with a string of characters in it, and then it'll run another subroutine that will actually gain access to that array where it's not usually supposed to have access to that array. So it's really interesting to see that, you know, yeah, this thing not only works, but I sat here and compiled it on my, you know, it's going to sound like sacrilege to some people, but on my Bash for Windows Ubuntu installation here, and I compiled it and ran it, and it ran, and it'll actually show you, you know, the stuff that, you know, this particular part of this program isn't supposed to see. So if you're a nerd like me, it's really cool to see in practice, but, you know, it's not too impressive. It's just showing you, you know, a bunch of bytes that's dumping out of memory. But it's still, you know, and like Ed was saying, you know, I mean, like, when we talk about bytes in memory, I mean, that's so vast now. You know, like, you really have to have an idea of what part of the memory you're looking in if you're trying to get something specific. Like, it's not like someone's going to dump, you know, all, you know, 64 gigs of your memory or, you know, 16 gigs of your memory and go through all that and try to find your passwords or whatever, but they can, and I think that's, you know, that's the real possibility here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's definitely take it seriously. You know, I mean, the thing that I always point to is when stuff like this happens, right, you know, there's, you know, obviously everybody gets all spun up and there's a lot of misinformation out there, right, and stuff like that happens. So obviously, you know, I'm not suggesting that people be cavalier, right? But I do think that, you know, that when things like this occur, it's an opportunity to help forward your security posture overall. Like, so number one, right, like the way that you message and communicate about this, like if you're able to, you know, develop kind of a 360 risk based view of this, where you're communicating both up the chain to senior leaders and executives in the board, right, and you're communicating to peer organizations, you're giving them kind of the straight skinny, you know, with the real details and the full information, and you're kind of open kimono about that. Like, that really kind of puts you forward and establishes, like, organizational credibility for you as a security practitioner, right, or assurance practitioner or risk practitioner or whatever flavor of practitioner you happen to be. So, you know, so I think that's kind of one thing. And then the other thing, too, is that I do think it's also a lesson in that, you know, the advice that I always give people, like, particularly, I do a lot of, cloud type of work, right? And one of the things, like, in a cloud context that I would tell people is, you know, this is a good lesson for, number one, why you should be doing stuff like formalized threat modeling, right? Because if you go through a threat modeling exercise, you know, for something, say, in a cloud environment, you know, one of the things that you might say is you come to that part where it talks about, you know, attacks against the segmentation model, right? And you say, hey, you know what? Like, I know that there's been issues in the past. You know, we talked about Rollhammer. We talked about, you know, there were a couple of Xen hypervisor issues, for example, last year that occurred. You know, there were issues with VMware in the past, all that kind of stuff, right? So we know that there's these segmentation attacks that can happen from time to time, including these, which impact more than cloud, but they definitely do impact cloud as well. You know, we know that these occur. So when it comes to that time where you're evaluating what are the controls that you're going to use and what are the mitigation strategies that you're going to use for that, you know, you can build them in and kind of future-proof what you're looking for. So anyway, my point is that I think, you know, looking at this kind of systematically is a way to become a better practitioner, just in my opinion. Do you guys agree with that? I mean, you know, are there other ways that you see, like, I mean, what's the good? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of bad news out there, right? I mean, is there any other good news? I mean, the communication thing struck me. The potential learning opportunity struck me.
I think one of the pieces of good news is the pretty rapid acknowledgement and response to this. Everyone's putting out something to help combat it. Windows, you know, that day put out the PowerShell script, for example, that you could run and identify if you were vulnerable. Now, let's all be honest here, right? If you've bought a computing device in the last 20 years, you're probably vulnerable, but it's still nice to have this script to be able to check. And they already pushed out an update that helps mitigate the vulnerability as well. So I think the response has been a bit quicker than the traditional, oh no, kind of response that can take a little bit more time that we are accustomed to. Traditionally, we're accustomed to a longer response time. Everyone's response to this has been pretty quick. It's been pleasant.
So, you know, to add on to that, there's no real finger pointing here either going on. Like, you know, usually it's like, oh, you know, Windows got hacked. Oh, Windows, you know, got hacked again. And then they had to put out, like, some kind of security thing. This is, everybody's in on this. Like, everybody's in this together. And so I do see, like, a huge conglomerate. Yeah, like you guys have been saying, like, there's this huge coming together of all these different vendors. You know, Amazon's working with Google on things now. It's just like, what's going on here? But, I mean, this is, like, a big problem that everybody has to solve. And not only that, but, you know, cybersecurity professionals live and breathe this stuff on a daily basis. Like, there are exploits that come out every day. And, you know, we constantly live in a state of, like, alertness when it comes to cybersecurity. But when something big like this happens, like you were saying, Ed, that really brings, you know, everybody in on it. And it's like, okay, what, you know, oh, okay. And you're right, it makes everybody more security conscious about what they're doing on a daily basis. And that's always a good thing.
So let me ask you guys a question, right? So I haven't seen a lot of this, but in the trade press, right, I've seen some people who are saying things like, you know, so the history of this, right, there was obviously a lot of rumor mongering that happened, like, before this was made public, right?
Right.
You know, I guess Linus Torvalds, right, had said a thing about, you know, he had not let anything, he didn't do anything wrong, but you know, the implication from, you know, some of the kernel patching activity was that this was going to be kind of a big deal, right?
Right.
You know, so there have been some people who have been kind of criticizing the way that this has been disclosed. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, we did a thing, there was a thing, I think it was in the online journal, maybe December, which was like a pro and con, you know, kind of point counterpoint about full disclosure versus kind of weaponization, right, and use of this for, you know, governments and whatnot, you know, kind of that debate. I'm just wondering, like, you know, what do you guys think about, like, A, how this was disclosed, and also B, like, you know, and actually just, you know, just open question, like, is this something that we expect nation states to, you know, to be leveraging going forward in terms of snooping on people?
I'll talk to the first point on that. The way it was disclosed, I thought, was much more organized than what we've seen in the past. I mean, you had these two white papers that were put out that pretty much explain everything, and they even had, like, their own website where you could go to and read up on them. I don't expect that to be the norm here. I mean, usually you have a CVE or something that pops up and then people discuss it, or, you know, there's kind of a one organization reveals it, or there's a zero day that comes to light. This seemed more methodical and more organized than what at least I'm usually exposed to.
So actually, to that point, let me drill down on that, because that's a little bit of a contentious point, right? Like, the fact that there was, like, a logo and a website and all that kind of stuff. Like, I've heard people complain about that in the trade press. Like, people saying, like, that people shouldn't be glamorizing a vulnerability by having, for example, a logo and website. On the one hand, I agree with you. I think, you know, it certainly made it easy to understand. I mean, you know, I started my day yesterday with a deep dive into both of those papers, right? You know, it certainly made it easy to find them. You know, and it's easier to refer to, you know, to some, you know, it's easier to say Spectre than it is to say CVE, you know, 2018,
right, exactly.
Whatever it is. You know, but by the same token, like, some people feel like maybe that's glamorizing it. I mean, what do you think? Like, is that,
I think you're going to have to take the pros with the cons on this one. Yes, it can be aggrandizing in the fashion in which it was revealed, and that it had logos and it had its own website. But at the same time, a lot of people were able to find out a lot of information about it a lot quicker. So yes, it can be contentious. Sure, it is. It makes a few questions arise. Should all these vulnerabilities get their own branding or something along those lines? Those are good questions to have. However, I think that it made it a lot easier for more people to understand what was going on and having that belly button there and having everything so organized.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, Dustin, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think everything, like Frank was saying, I think everything, you know, was came out so methodically, and it looked really, you know, giving something a logo and shoving it out there on the internet. Ever since, you know, exploits come out, you know, everybody wants to put, like, oh, I made this exploit, you know, because, you know, it's a big deal for a security person to become published and say that, hey, I found this, or hey, I found that, you know. So I feel like that's been kind of going on for a really long time as far as, like, glorifying something, like, you know, even since Heartbleed. You know, Heartbleed kind of had a, like a logo with, like, a heart and, like, you know, something else going on it, too. So, you know, I think if whatever we need to do to catch the public's eye, you know, the people who don't think about cybersecurity every day but need to, like, that, I think whatever we need to do to get that message across is what we need to do. If that includes, you know, flashy branding or you know, whatever, then that's what we need to do.
Now, in your experience, have people become more security aware over the years?
So I've been doing security for a while, right? You know, I got started doing this in, I guess, like 1995, 1996 time frame, right? And I remember back in the day, right, I would explain to people what I did for a living, and, you know, people would look at me like I had two heads, right? This was the time when the RSA conference, like, for those folks who've been to the RSA conference, it's huge, right? Like, this was a time when, you know, my first RSA, which I think was, like, the 1995, 1996 RSA or whatever it was, you know, I mean, it was, like, 200 people, right? It was just not, like, a super huge show like it is today. So, I mean, I think you've had, like, a huge surge in interest. Like, it's kind of, you know, as tech has become more entrenched in people's lives and has enabled business more directly and stuff like that, like, it's become a bigger deal. You know, I mean, a lot of folks don't remember this, but, you know, for you young whippersnappers, the even why we have full disclosure in the first place, like, it's actually a really interesting story. I mean, if you go look it up, right, there was a group that had said, hey, you know, here's a vulnerability in the way that Microsoft is doing, you know, password challenge, you know, the way that the challenge response process works for, you know, for passwords into the Microsoft ecosystem. And, you know, Microsoft basically said, hey, you know, that's a theoretical vulnerability, like, it's, you know, ridiculous, right? And, you know, people said, oh, yeah? Well, you know, here's how you, you know, go and exploit that, and we're just making that available to the world at large. And, you know, sure enough, that kind of embarrassed them into responding to it appropriately, right? You know, so I think it's, people are taking it more seriously, but by the same token, maybe it's just me, and I'm interested in Dustin, Frank, what you guys think about this, but I also feel like, while there are, you know, while more people are taking it seriously, I also feel like there's a lot of folks who are coming into the profession who are just, yeah, it's almost like, have you guys heard of the Dunning-Kruger effect? You guys ever heard that term, Dunning-Kruger?
No.
No.
All right, so Dunning-Kruger is basically like, it's an effect that happens, for people and how they perceive the world, right? And it's basically like somebody who doesn't know anything will think that there's no skill involved in doing something because they don't understand it. They, you know, kind of assume that it's easy, right? And that's, I mean, it's more complicated than that, obviously, but, you know, that's kind of the, you know, the in a nutshell version. And, you know, I think there's a lot more people who are entering the industry who are really not all that skilled, but yet they don't understand that they're not, and that kind of sets us up for, you know, for something dangerous. And that's why I kind of feel like the work that, you know, that you guys in particular have been doing on skills-based assessment, you know, and actually trying to understand what makes a person good at their job and be able to test for that is really super valuable. I don't know. That's just my opinion. I mean, what do you guys think?
Go ahead, Frank.
We could go on for on this one for a day and a half, but I agree with you on that, Ed. I think that this kind of gets to the point that cybersecurity as a field, there are multiple different types of cybersecurity meanings, and it is a very subjective term depending on what group of individuals you're speaking with, and that hasn't done it many favors, because when it comes down to actually understanding the technical realities of it and doing the hands-on job, and admittedly, there are other parts of cybersecurity that don't require as deep a technical understanding, but it's dangerous because you can have a lot of people in the field who, when they're interacting with something like this, it doesn't go beyond an understanding objectively or beyond the buzzword realm. So then I think I would say, yes, I agree with you that how we're spending our day creating training that then will ensure you understand not just what you're talking about, but how to do a task and how to perform a capability and how to implement these ideas. It's one thing to know, for example, in this instance, what this attack is and what it can do from a discussion standpoint. It's another to be able to sit down at a system, identify if that system is vulnerable to this vulnerability, and then take the steps to ensure that the system doesn't stay vulnerable. So I think you're right when you say there's kind of a danger there in the field that a lot of people can talk about something thinking they have the understanding, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they have the capability.
Absolutely. And just to jump in on that, you know, especially an exploit as sophisticated as this one, where we're getting down into the architecture of how a microprocessor works, I mean, it's mind-blowing. Like, it's just like, you know, who knows assembly programming language anymore? You know, I'm sure there are people out there, and you know, but for the most part, you know, we're at a totally different level of computing than we've ever been in, you know, in this evolution that we have with computers. And we just, you know, there are things that are forgotten, and assembly code is one of those things that's forgotten. And this is directly what's going on here, you know, is that this machine code is being executed. But again, who writes in machine code? You know, who truly understands what's going on here? Like, if you're not if you're not an Intel engineer, like, you really have to have a very specific skill set to get down into the weeds on some of these things. And, you know, like you said, we've been trying to create training to, you know, maybe not get you all the way into the weeds of x86 architecture or ARM architecture, but at least get you to a point where if you read something about this or you see something like this exploit, you know, you can take a look at it and get it on a level to where you can defend yourself against the attack or defend your company or your customers against the attack.
Just to follow on that, right? Like, so in the interest of, you know, in the interest of, you know, because obviously everybody wants to be well-informed, right? Like, if you're a practitioner and you're working in security or whatever, you want to be well-informed. You want to do that, right? You want to be good at what you do. Like, I mean, you guys have been, you know, working on this since, you know, since the news broke. Like, what do you recommend that people do? Like, in terms of, like, if, you know, for the person who's listening to this, right, and they're, you know, they're saying to themselves, like, oh, you know, I understand now what the issue is, sort of, you know, I kind of, you know, I understand kind of what the issues are. Like, what do I do now? Like, you know, just so to make sure we've covered it, like, what do you guys recommend that they go do?
So it's really interesting. Like, you know, you look on some of these websites and, you know, you're trying to figure out what to do. And some of the suggestions for how to fix it is go find a new processor.
Oh, no.
Which is like, okay. But realistically, yeah, realistically, I mean, kind of, right? It's weird, but, you know, and there is some stuff at the OS kernel level that you can do. Microsoft is saying that they're not releasing anything, I think, until later on, early next week. And they have something out, right, at least a pushed update until next week, and then you can go on their website right now and download it. But even that, so even downloading that and running that now, if you have antivirus, there have been reports that, you know, that'll make your antivirus crash and then your OS will blue screen. So it's hard to say right now. This is so new and so vast. that it's impossible. Like, you know, just keep yourself informed. When a patch comes out, patch. You know, I mean, if your computer blue screens, or you know, if you know, maybe not due to your servers right now, but it still is going to make your computer safer. That's my suggestion. That's my 2 cents.
So I have a Commodore 64 in my attic. Should I haul that down and hook it up?
Get it out, and that'll be the safest computer on the planet. I was just talking about that the other day.
That's literally what he recommended this morning. He said, "I'm going to get my Commodore, and yep, I have a trash 80.
I have a trash 80 sitting right here.
There you go. But no, in all seriousness, I mean, is it like, I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot of patching activity. You know, there's not everybody has a patch yet, right? But there's a lot of like patching and updating and whatnot that's going on. So you apply the patch. That's, you know, certainly that's something to do. You know, what's kind of step two in your guys' opinion?
I'd say the patching is important, but also making sure you have it. We put out that video, and you've got a really great blog write-up that you put out. Being aware of it and then following a few steps, if you can, on your system, if you have the permissions to then, you know, implement those and keep an eye out as all these patches come out. Because, you know, when it comes to hardware, one patch for one application isn't going to be the complete fix. This is going to be a multi-patch experience from multiple different vendors that are on your system. Because, I mean, how do you patch, as Dustin said, how do you patch this hardware issue aside from moving over back to your Commodore system, for example? So staying aware, keeping an eye out, and knowing when and where to patch, which is going to be even more difficult when you're talking about bigger enterprises, because there's a whole patch management process there, right? You can't just, it's not like when you're at home and you can go, oh, download, got it. You have to actually go through the whole process of getting a patch approved, having it tested, then getting it approved again, and then putting it out, and then rolling it out in the appropriate fashion. So it's going to be, I won't use the word fun for a lot of network managers and system managers, but it's going to be an experience.
And then, like we've mentioned before, you know, in this podcast so far, is it's a great opportunity to do end user training to make sure that people know. You know, we've seen with these two particular CVEs that have come out, or three particular CVEs that have come out, we've seen that it's mostly, or you know, that the proof of concepts are kind of, I'm saying this with a big caveat, are kind of you know, have to be executed locally. There has been one or two things out there going around where there's like a JavaScript type implementation of this attack. There are remote exploitation capabilities, but when we talk about, you know, a piece of software running on a computer, what we're really talking about is somebody having to download that piece of software and actually execute it themselves, an end user having to do that. And I think this is a great opportunity to, you know, for enterprises and, you know, any company to sit their people down and say, okay, let's just go over, you know, basic, you know, computer security 101. You know, don't open up email attachments that you don't know who they're from. You know, and go through that whole thing again. And it's always good to refresh on that. It's always good.
Yeah, I mean, actually, as you said that, I mean, one thing occurred to me that I've just kind of noticed happening, which is this, like, the, you know, people will get this information from, you know, they'll hear something, like, because they hear it on the radio on the way into work or whatever, or you know, they have maybe they don't understand kind of technically how it works, right? So they kind of hear these things and get, you know, kind of like really panicked about them, and you know, you know, that's never good, right? Particularly when it's, you know, a CEO or a board member or what have you, and they're asking questions like, hey, I've heard that, you know, every machine is vulnerable and that it can't be patched and all this kind of stuff. Like, there's a lot of panic out there, and you know, like I said, I do really think, like, you know, to your point, I feel like this is a good opportunity for security people to, well, and you know, and like I said, assurance and risk as well, right? To you know, to know the facts and, you know, be kind of the, you know, not boring, but, you know, but the almost kind of relaxed voice in the room of somebody saying, hey, you know, it's not time, you know, we don't need to panic about this. We just need to approach it calmly and collectively and with the facts and, you know, in an educated, workmanlike kind of way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, sometimes I hate to say this, but, you know, as a pen tester, sometimes that scare factor works in your favor, though. And I'm not saying to panic or anything like that. You're right. They do not panic. Like, this is all going to get resolved eventually. Keeping a cool head is going to be part of that. But when you have the attention of the CEO or the chief level, you know, when you have the attention of a corporation like that, or any corporation of the chief level, and it's like, hey, let's talk about this. It's just great. It creates dialogue, and that's great. That's definitely what we need. Yep.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And finally, can you let our listeners know of resources that they can consult to learn more about these vulnerabilities?
We talked about the websites for the Meltdown and Spectre papers, right? Which is kind of if you go to spectreattack.com or something like that. If you go to like one of them, they have like both papers there now, right? Each of the two attacks do. But are there other resources that folks might, you know, think would be helpful? I mean, so like the ones that I found really helpful was there's one that's kind of like a really, there's a really kind of workmanlike, very no nonsense, not technical, overview of kind of like the what does it mean to me impacts that's up on Errata Security. I don't know if folks, know that. It's just somebody's blog. I don't know them personally, but I happen to read their blog and I found that resource to be helpful. The Google Project Zero post I thought was really very helpful. The Microsoft one, Microsoft has a thing about this, which I found to be very helpful because it has all their products and the status of the patches for it. Those are the resources I found to be most helpful. I mean, we've tried to put up a few, but do you guys have any others that you would recommend that folks look at?
No, I mean, the typical ones are usually the good ones, in my opinion. There's no real new places, I think, in this instance, that you really have to dive deep into. Dustin, what do you think?
Right, no, yeah, definitely the Google document that you mentioned earlier, Ed, that was definitely one of the first things that I read. They just did such a good job on it. The original white paper, if you don't want to get too into it, obviously there are some YouTube videos, believe it or not, where they actually go and they don't deep dive into it, but they touch the surface of it and kind of explain to a normal user what this means to them. Of course, as always, I mean, Exploit Database has the proof of concept code up there. For some of you more technical people out there, if you want to take a look at that, again, I found it incredibly interesting, and you can tweak the code a little bit, and you'll need to tweak the code a little bit to compile it anyways, but it's just interesting to see this, this exploit happen from a technical standpoint.
It's incredible. Awesome.
I have a question about that. So, like, if I were to download that code, right, and if I run it, and you've done this, which is why I'm asking you, right? So if I run it in a debugger, because of the fact that it has to do the pre-execution stuff, like, if I run it in a debugger, will I still see the effects, or do I have to run it, just run it, in an environment, not in a debugger? Does it matter, debugger or not debugger?
Yeah, so theoretically, you should be able to, I have not run any debugger yet, but theoretically you should be able to see the memory, being accessed that shouldn't be allowed to be accessed. I honestly compiled it and ran it in a bash for Windows and kind of just watched it there, and it was, if you look at the code, you can see where this particular code should be isolated from the rest of the code. This particular, code that gets loaded into memory, this particular string of characters that gets loaded into memory, should be isolated. And then you see this code that, if you know C or C++, then you should be able to, okay, yeah, that code should not be accessible. And then all of a sudden it starts printing on your screen, and you're like, oh, man, that's really neat. It's really neat how they do it, or how this proof of concept works. So, if you want to run it in a debugger, IDA or, whatever you use, you'll definitely be able to see a little bit more than what I was able to see. But for me alone, that was enough for me to be like, whoa, it's kind of like that, that aha moment.
Thanks, everyone. And that's all we have time for in this episode of the Isoca podcast. If you're interested in reading the disclosure articles Ed mentioned, check out the online edition of Volume 6, 2017 of the Isoca Journal.